The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Got your resume up to date? Then you too can apply for the soon-to-be-open job of U.S. Senator from Georgia. But President Trump might be reading that resume and pass on his thoughts to the governor, who'll make that decision. Meanwhile, the race for the other Georgia Senate seat got a new contestant. And the Atlanta school system has to figure out what next after the superintendent's contract was not renewed. A whole smorgasbord in this serving of the political breakfast. Welcome to One and All. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined again by Theron Johnson, who's a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign, and Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Hello again to you both.
Good to be back. Happy Friday.
Governor Kemp has invited anyone interested in the appointment to be Georgia's U.S. Senator, at least until the special election next year. Submit your resume. I presume both of you have already sent yours.
I'm actually editing my resume right now. I'm trying to figure out how much stuff I need to put on there that shows my bipartisanship. I don't know if Brian has edited his resume yet, but I'm in the process of submitting mine later this weekend.
No, I don't want the appointment. I'm planning on primarying whoever gets the appointment.
And we talked
from
about
the left or right, whichever, whatever I need to do politically.
You know, it's funny. We talked about that last time, Brian, about whether the appointee, assuming it is a Republican, which is a safe assumption, could still run the risk of being primaried, and whether that primary challenge would be serious next year.
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility. You're going to have multiple Democrats get in, more than likely. So I think having multiple Republicans is also very possible, particularly with this new process that we're undertaking with the application. We could get somebody who looks really good on paper who turns out to not be a great candidate. That's, you know, the danger of any selection for Brian Kemp, really.
Now, the governor has said this is all an effort to be transparent in the selection process. But Brian, he doesn't have to pick someone who submits a pitch that would be examined publicly, does he? He could still talk to people quietly on the side who haven't submitted an application and pick one of them.
I think he runs the risk of making the process look silly if he does that. If you're going to do it this way, you've got to say on the front end, the person that we pick will be somebody who enters the resume through this portal. I also think that changes the complete dynamics of how we thought this was going to play out. This changes everything. A lot of people who may have been in the private conversations with Kemp now aren't going to want to put their name out there as someone who is perhaps not particularly happy with the job or elected office they have right now.
Like a member of Congress, for instance?
A member of any elected office, whether in the State House, State Senate, or even a corporate CEO whose board may have their eyebrows raised when their name gets put out there. Like, hey, are you not happy that year? Are you not happy making $3 million a year, $10 million a year?
Especially if that company wants to be non-political in its public face.
Exactly. Yes.
What I think this is, Dennis, it's really twofold. One is public trust. I think that this governor has shown that he is bringing an unorthodox approach to governing. The second thing is that I think that they were getting inundated with so many calls, so many people saying, pick this person, pick that person. Hey, I want it. I mean, I heard there was a lot of lobbying going on in the president's suite at the University of Georgia game for all the home games that were there. There were some people there talking amongst themselves.
Well, there's, especially some of those early games where Georgia's going to roll up the score.
Yeah.
And the game's
once it gets to like 28-0, I mean, all you're doing is talking about politics.
Yeah.
If I'm someone who is strongly working behind the scenes and calling everyone who I think is close to the governor, you know, you've got to make a decision on whether or not you want to follow this process that we put in place. And so I think what this does, it kind of puts the Democrats in a very tough situation because, look, what Democrats were going to do, no matter who he selected, we were going to say, oh, my God, look at who he selected. This process wasn't transparent. It wasn't open. The public didn't have any input.
How much of this, Theron, and I'll ask Brian this as well, do you think is a reaction by the governor to the vociferous criticism he got as Secretary of State, where the criticism was he wasn't being transparent, he was involved in behind-the-scenes effort to suppress votes, something he vociferously denied. But there were allegations that he was doing all sorts of things behind the scenes and not transparent. And now as governor, he's trying to project a very different image.
You know, I think that's part of it. But I think also what he's doing, Dennis, is that he's sort of saying, okay, if you want to be a U.S. senator, you know, I want Georgians to feel like they have some input, then go through this sort of new portal that we've created. The challenge with this also is that the press is already filed open records requests, mm-hmm. and then we'll be filing additional open records requests. And so this is a good way for the press to put some names out there to kind of really take the spotlight off who the governor is going to select, but now it's about who has applied.
I do think he wants to go out about this a new way. And as I said, it changes the dynamics of how it would work otherwise, but maybe that's okay. This is going to change the dynamics. And one thing that he may be setting a precedent, because once you go this route, it's hard for him to change it the next time or for a future governor to change it the next time.
Does it really, though, scare off a potential heavyweight who wanted to remain behind the scenes?
It very well could. And there are some out there that are going to pull back. And there are some, you know, calling around today, asking their advisors, asking their friends and supporters, or people they trust, what should I do now? I mean, I've already reached out to the governor's office. If I sign up, it's going to be out there. My constituents will think that I don't like my job anymore. It's tricky.
But for our listeners, I want to say this. Yes, this portal is about public trust. It's about transparency. It's about being inclusive. But at the end of the day, Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, is going to select a man or a woman, maybe a minority, to go on to be the person that he believes that will be the best person to fill the seat of Johnny Isaacson.
But that person's going to be running in 2020 on a mm-hmm. ticket that includes Donald Trump and David Perdue. How much weight will they have in the governor's decision?
I think they're going to, you know, one of the things that Heath Garrett, Brian, I know, is mutual friends of ours, he did an excellent job explaining that what Senator Isaacson sort of publicly said to the governor was, hey, I'm not going to get in this process. Now, if you ask me for my input and my guidance, mm-hmm. I will do that. I think
Senator Isaacson told me that, too.
Yeah, and I think David Perdue is taking a similar approach. Hey, I definitely want to be involved, but only if asked. Now, I don't want to, you know, get into speculating what happens in Republican politics with this president, but I think that based on how this president has conducted himself and his behavior, I find it very hard to believe that there's not going to be a text or a call made to the governor to sort of suggest someone. I just find it very hard to believe that will not happen.
Look, David Perdue's kind of in the same spot of other state leaders, even though he's on the ballot. I don't think that he's got more say with Governor Kemp than a leader in the General Assembly. President Trump, however, is a different ballgame. If he weighs in for a candidate of his choice, that would be decisive. Kemp cannot run the risk of getting crossways with him. He can't run the risk of having the president attacking him on Twitter. We don't know if Trump is going to weigh in, but if he does, it will be very hard to go a different direction.
As you know, Brian, because you worked with Casey Cagle, who ran against Governor Kemp in the primary, a presidential tweet can mean a whole lot.
In 24 hours, it went from 50-50 to 70-30, and that influence hasn't changed. And in fact, going into his election year, it may be even stronger. It doesn't matter how much his approval ratings fluctuate up or down nationally or with the entire electorate. With the Republican base, it's 90%, and that's who Brian Kemp needs to be reelected.
Let's turn to the other race, the David Perdue race. John Ossoff, who ran in a jungle primary in the 6th district and demonstrated that he can make it to a runoff and almost win the seat, instead of jumping into that free-for-all on the Isaacson seat side, Theron, he decided to jump into a field with three Democrats in it already to challenge David Perdue.
And I want to applaud John Ossoff. I think this is one of the best rollouts I've seen. I mean, he did a Q&A with the local Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He did some national
But he announced
media.
Initially on MSNBC in New York.
Well, so here we go. So, you know, like I know Dennis.
He always likes to be outside the district.
You know, John's a friend. I'm going to defend him on
he's,
that one.
He's not my friend, too.
Well, I think the reason he did that, Dennis and Brian, is because, as we know, MSNBC, I believe, is number one. Definitely, if they're not number one overall, they're number one when it comes to Democratic voters. But what he did, Dennis, he immediately nationalized the race, which, to your point, he plays in that space very well. And so what he did, Dennis, by announcing on MSNBC, he nationalized the race, then he brought it back home, and then he focused a lot on why he believes he's the best to beat David Perdue. And I think that if you really look at some of the things that he said, I think he had a very sharpened, sort of poignant message at David Perdue. And then I think what he also did is that he took the race a little bit to the left, which he's got to do. So to answer your question, why the primary against David Perdue and not the jungle primary, I think John Ossoff and his team are saying, hey, we can operate in this space. You know, we have a progressive message that we can raise national money and local money. And then also, I think he needs to get his name recognition up around the state. So going for the primary and doing that earlier and getting across the state will help him if he's the nominee for when he gets to November of next year.
There's already a progressive in that race, at least one, Mayor Ted Terry from Clarkston. But the idea here is that with the others in the race, Mayor Tomlinson, Teresa Tomlinson, former Mayor Teresa Tomlinson of Columbus, and Sarah Riggs Amico, who just ran for lieutenant governor, it sounds like you're saying the Ossoff money might make a difference in that field.
If I break down the race right now, listen, this is how it breaks down really quickly. Let's start with Sarah Riggs Amico. I think that if you were to put her in a poll right now, she's leading because she's got the name recognition. She's been statewide before.
And she has a statewide network.
Teresa Tomlinson has been getting ready to get ready, as Maynard Jackson would say, for a long time, right? So she finally announced she didn't have a really good quarter raising money, but she's been working hard, and I think she's building up a statewide network. Terry kind of owned what many were proclaiming as sort of the socialist space because of some of the things that he said in his rollout, and you look at the great work that he's done in the mayor as mayor of Clarkston, Georgia. Now here enters John Ossoff, who I think is a combination of what Teresa and Ted brings to the table, but doesn't have the statewide name recognition that Sarah has. But he has shown the ability out of everyone else that he can raise the millions and millions of dollars to dominate fundraising. Not necessarily saying he's going to win, but he'll definitely be able to dominate fundraising in a Democratic primary here in Georgia.
Does that push the eventual nominee, assuming no matter who it is, to the left and make it easier for David Perdue to simply say, they're nominating a socialist here?
One of the criticisms that John Ossoff received is that he didn't go hard enough or harder against Donald Trump. You got to remember, when he got into the runoff with Karen Handel, many thought he kind of maybe pulled back a little bit and just really tried to talk about going to Washington to be an independent voice. I think he's learned from that. I don't think he's going to go too far left to the point where if he's a nominee, he can't come back to the middle and be very competitive against David Perdue.
Now, I would have rolled it out differently if I was him. Given that the attack on him in 2017 was he lived outside the district, I would have done something in the 6th district, had a big crowd. We know he can get a big crowd. I would have done something very local and then gone to MSNBC to try to tell his national donors, hey, I'm back. You remember me. You gave to me last time. But what I see stacking up, it seems like all the, like they've said, okay, running against Perdue, you got to be a white person. We only got white people in this side. Okay, this is going to be the white person race. And then whoever's going to take on the appointee of Kemp, I'm going to say you're not going to see white people get in it. I think it's going to be – they need to have a minority candidate in there. It's mandatory, frankly. But the other reason why you would want to take on Perdue as opposed to the open seat, even though it's an unknown, is Democrats know that the special election for the Kemp appointee will have multiple candidates and will therefore go to a runoff in January. That is a huge disadvantage for a Democrat. The Democrats got a much better chance on Election Day in November than they do in a special in January. So they're leery of that race for that reason. But we are all in anticipating, just as we are anticipating who Kemp is going to pick, who is the dynamic minority Democrat who can emerge to get in this race and try to replicate what Stacey Abrams did. Stacey Abrams showed us the formula.
And she said it would be political malpractice for national Democrats not to invest in Georgia. But, Theron, if they size up their chances of winning Senate races here and they say, yeah, we might not make it, but we really need to flip the Senate, so we got to devote our resources elsewhere, how much of a debate internally among Democrats is that going to be? Because Democrats have to figure out where they spend their resources nationally, not just here in Georgia.
So the debate is already happening right now in the Democratic Party, Dennis. I was in Washington, D.C. last week for the annual conference for the Congressional Black Caucus. Brian was invited, but somehow, you know, I guess he didn't get the invitation, or maybe he just declined. But, you know, they're a caucus that, you know, believes in representing all races, just a little bit slant to the African-American race. But what I heard in Washington, D.C. was three things, Dennis. Number one, okay, can a Democrat pick up where Stacey Abrams left off? And why did she lose? And, you know, we can be on this podcast all day talking about different reasons of why Democrats think that she was unsuccessful. The second conversation was, okay, if we got two Senate races going on in Georgia, tell me how Georgia becomes a higher priority in the South over Florida, North Carolina, which is a state that we know Dems have won in previously, but you just had a special election there where the Republican won. And then, you know, still people kind of look at, believe it or not, Texas. You know, you got a big Senate race there going on as well. And then the third thing is, okay, what Brian just said, we know that there are some qualified people of color out there. Where are they? And number one, if they're serious about getting in the race, how would they raise the money? And do they have enough local infrastructure in place to run side by side, sort of as a ticket, whoever the nominee is going to be against Purdue?
Now, but is it a catch-22? Because in order for them to decide to run, they would have to extract a promise from the National Democrats that they'd get some national Democratic support.
I think what they're trying to really figure out is what is the 50-plus-1 strategy, and what worked again with the statewide race of Stacey Abrams and what didn't work. And then more importantly, what they're also saying to Georgia folks is, as much as this is a Georgia race, it's a national race. And so the Democratic nominee for president, he or she, is going to play a big role about how many people decide to give their resources to the state of Georgia.
Brian, the variable here is, because we've all always talked about how the shape of the Georgia electorate is changing, does either party really know who's going to turn out to vote in 2020? I mean, we rely on polling data, you rely on past performance, but given the change of Georgia's demographics, are both sides really kind of shooting in the dark here?
We know it's changing. The Republicans are aware of it. They are responding to it. What we saw with Stacey Abrams was a historic, monumental effort to register the least likely voters who would vote Democrat if they voted. And so she registered a lot of folks. And, you know, of course, she had some controversy about how she did it and how ethical it was. But nevertheless, there was an impact. Republicans have taken notice. And if you look at what the Trump Organization in Georgia is doing, along with the state GOP, along with the RNC, is a huge focus today on finding those unlikely voters who love Trump and getting them back out. You know, we did have a dip of people who came out to vote for Trump in 2016 who didn't come back last year.
But now Trump will be right at the top of the ticket again.
And so you got to presume that some of those people who've only voted for Trump in the last 30 years are going to show up again. So, but Republicans still have got to go into these areas where they know the unregistered folks are Republicans. You look at Northeast Georgia, Northwest Georgia, for example, maybe parts of Middle Georgia, and you got to pound them with information.
So it's all about the ground game.
Well, I want to ask Brian something, and Brian's my friend, so I'm going to catch him off guard here a little bit. But an Atlanta Journal-Constitution paper yesterday, it was an article in the Metro section where it says this guy, his name is Brandon Schrocka. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's a white, gay, part-time hairdresser. And he's leading this effort called Walk Away, to try to encourage more African-Americans to walk away from the Democratic Party of Georgia and to join the GOP. And Brian has mentioned on this podcast, and I think very intelligently, that, hey, if the Republican Party in Georgia want to retain their leadership and retain their influence in electoral politics, you got to look at expanding your party. So I would ask Brian, I don't know if he's read the article.
I have.
This guy is clearly tied to Russia. And in the article, it also says that he's tied to Putin, right? And so my question is, Brian, what do you think about this effort to try to take minorities away from the Democratic Party at a time when you got a gentleman who has Russia ties, is in an article with the whole walkaway hashtag, and is coming to Atlanta to try to recruit more African Americans to the Republican Party? Do you think this is a good tactic?
Well, you know, I think there are some non-Russia-backed efforts along the same lines. And I will say the Russians have also been one to exploit Black Lives Matter and other groups like that in their attempts to inflame racial tensions. So they do it on both sides. But I would say on that, you're seeing that with some high-profile Trump folks that are using that same language. And I think that there's a feeling, okay, this is always so awkward, you know, like, I can't say what African Americans should or shouldn't think. It's not my role. But their political strength, their ability to be courted and have a seat at the table would be helped if they were gettable for Republicans sometimes. It would definitely make Republicans go out there and listen to their concerns and be much more open to that. And look, there's some effort the Republicans have to make too to do that outreach. It goes both ways. But I think eventually it will break. You saw double-digit African-American men vote for Kemp. You saw significant African-American men vote for Trump. So it's out there. Obviously, Black women are going to be a much bigger hill to conquer.
Real quickly on these two points. Brian, as we speak, Republican leaders in four states, South Carolina, Arizona, Nevada, and Kansas, have already scrapped their 2020 presidential primaries. Michigan's party leaders changed the rules to make sure that President Trump will get all of that state's Republican convention delegates. Any move to do the same thing here in Georgia?
In anticipation of this question, I reached out to Georgia Republican Party Chairman David Schaefer, and he said it's in code in Georgia that we have to have a presidential primary. And so it's not an option, literally, because the law requires it. So that's not going to happen here. And frankly, I don't like this happening in other states. I don't think President Trump has anything to fear from a primary. It's going to be a show of strength for him if he has a primary. He's going to get 90% of the vote. I mean, that's what you want. You look so strong, and it gives you an excuse to go to some of these swing states early on, have events, build your political networks there under the guise of you're having a primary election.
So this is what democracy doesn't look like. Brian is right. If you look at the polling, if you look at where, you know, these Trump loyalists, Trump, I don't think Brian is a Trump loyalist. I think he's a compassionate conservative Republican who bends towards, you know, Trump policies every now and then.
Build the wall.
Oh, God, I can't believe you said that. It's just what this president has done to what we used to know as a Republican Party. What you're seeing is that these states that have basically said we're not going to do a primary, they should be ashamed of themselves. Now, I'm very happy to hear that former state senator David Schaefer has said to Brian that that's not an option and they're going to follow the law. But what is going to continue to happen, and our listeners know this, this president and his people, whoever's running his campaign now, I don't know who it is going to continue to try to maybe encourage some of these states to not have this primary. And let's talk about why he doesn't want to have this primary. We know that the people who are looking at running against Donald Trump.
William Weld, former Massachusetts governor. You got former Congressman Sanford from South Carolina. Who am I missing? There's
Joe Walsh
from
Illinois.
Yes.
So what this does now
former
is
congressman.
That if you put the president of the United States of America up in a debate, in a public televised debate to the world, it's not good for Donald Trump. Yes, he's got a record that he believes is strong on, but what it does is that it gives the Democrats a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of things that they can look at, that they can use against this president once he goes on and becomes the nominee. And so I think that Republicans have got to be very, very careful about breaking up the democracy that many of us as Americans are proud of.
Let's take a look at the Democratic side. Theron, here in Georgia, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms has been the most visible supporter of former Vice President Joe Biden among Georgia Democratic leaders. Not the only one, but the most visible one. She's traveled with him. She's gone to South Carolina to help shore up support there. And she endorsed him early, back in June. What's the thinking behind that? I mean, presumably, not to be cynical, she gets something out of this.
Well, it's no quid pro quo here, Dennis. It's really a mayor who has known former Vice President Biden when she was a councilperson. Number two, to be brutally honest with you, I've talked to the mayor about this, is that if you look at what the Biden team did along with Joe Biden's direct outreach to the mayor, they just did a better job of courting her support. I mean, former Vice President Biden called the mayor directly, would talk to her about issues like criminal justice reform. She was able to provide some ideas and some feedback to him about what she was doing here in Atlanta with repurposing the jail. It's not closed, Brian. I know a lot of Republicans in the city like to say that the jail is closed. It's being repurposed.
As a halfway house for former City Hall employees.
And then the third thing is, you know, she was able to talk to him about infrastructure. And so what has happened is that it's a mutual beneficial relationship where now the former Vice President of the United States, who's running to be the President of the United States of America, who has to get the Democratic nomination first, has teamed up with a mayor who, love it or not, Atlanta is revered internationally, and definitely an African-American woman, as Brian has talked about, that can join the Biden team, that can go in early primary states like South Carolina, Nevada, and then as the pathway to 270 continues to grow, she can go to other states.
270 electoral votes.
Correct, 270, yeah. So then the other thing is that this is a mayor, too, who's loyal. And she is loyal to people who are loyal to her. And there was some criticism about her coming out so early. Mm-hmm. But once she makes up her mind, once she feels that this is the right decision for her and she's prayed about it, and she thinks that Vice President Biden is the best person to go on to defeat Donald Trump, I think she made a decision. I think she's actively out here campaigning with him to make sure he's the nominee.
You know, what I think could possibly happen here is if you look back to the historical example of 08, you had a lot of residual goodwill for the Clintons amongst the African-American electorate. And you saw a lot of high-profile African-American elected officials come out for Hillary Clinton. John Lewis
famously before he switched.
Before he switched. Thus my point, that if you see a person of color surging in this primary, whether it be Senator Harris, Senator Booker. Who I think could be strong candidates, particularly in South Carolina, which is where, you know, Obama came out and just stomped Hillary Clinton in 08. I think you would see a mass movement toward that candidate amongst the African-American leadership. That's my guess based on history. I do think that Mayor Bottoms' endorsement is a great one because she's such a great person to, like, introduce you at rallies because she comes across as a mom in the neighborhood. I mean, she's very relatable in the speeches that I've seen her give. That is a rare quality.
Theron, 26 African-American Georgia lawmakers have now endorsed Biden, joining the mayor, including one of the biggest voices in state Democratic politics, Carolyn Hughley, state representative from Columbus. But the reason I'm bringing her up is we talked in a previous podcast about the potential help that Kamala Harris could get here from the network of members of her sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, the AKAs. But if I recall, Carolyn Hughley is one of the most visible AKAs in the state. She organizes AKA Day at the Capitol when hundreds of sorors come. So her voice is big in that sorority that Kamala Harris is also a member of, and Carolyn Hughley just endorsed Joe Biden.
Well, Dennis, I want to tell you, my wife is a soror, as you said in mm-hmm. our podcast, and you were the topic of a brunch recently where she went back and let some of her sorors listen to you use the term soror. So all the AKAs in Georgia love you, Dennis O'Hare, because you gave them a huge shout-out. So I definitely want to make sure you're aware of that. No, listen, and let's not forget that Calvin Smyre, the dean of the Georgia delegation, also endorsed former Vice President Biden.
Oh, yeah,
But what's going on here is exactly what you just pointed out, Dennis, and that's why, you know, we love having you as a moderator. You're getting into sort of a systemic challenge for the Democratic hopefuls that are running against former Vice President Joe Biden. You got someone like Kamala Harris, who went to Howard University. Mm-hmm. I think Howard University Law School, who's an AKA at the Alpha chapter at Howard University of Alpha Kappa Alpha.
Where it was founded.
Where it was founded. And still Carolyn Hughley decided to go with Vice President Joe Biden for whatever reason. But here's the thing I think that is interesting, too. It's a generational divide. To be very fair to Senator Kamala Harris, if you look across the country, she does have a wide spread of support from members of the sorority of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. But I think, you know, Carolyn Hughley, not to say that she's too seasoned, I think that, again, I go back to she's worked, she knows Joe Biden, and I think that many of them who have endorsed him feel that he's the best person to go on and beat Donald Trump. What the Harris campaign has got to do is that they now have got to sort of figure out a way to go and to get more supports from people in her sorority, but also she's got to do a better job of having an open conversation with the American people and that African-American women feel comfortable with. And so I think that Carolyn Hughley's endorsement, and you also have, I think, Darshan Kendricks, who's a state representative from DeKalb, who's also endorsed former Vice President Biden, too. So she's a little younger. But listen, the Biden team, I'm telling you, what you guys don't see is their outreach to these particular African-American electeds and African-American politicos across the country is unparalleled to what I'm seeing from other campaigns.
We've got a lot more to get into in this edition of The Political Breakfast, including the Atlanta Board of Education vote not to renew Superintendent Maria Karstarfin's contract and Georgia's decision to join the opioid settlement. So stay right here.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back with The Political Breakfast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare, along with Democratic strategist Theron Johnson and Republican strategist Brian Robinson. Maria Karstarfin's contract as Atlanta school superintendent was not renewed by the board. Dr. Karstarfin told my colleague Rose Scott in an interview on Closer Look that she had gotten excellent evaluations, was given no particular reason, like really specific reason why her contract wasn't being renewed. Theron, do we have any specific or even unified reason from the majority of school board members who decided not to renew the contract?
Yes. And I want to encourage our listeners to stay tuned. Some of these graduation rates in particular that she quoted, all this is a great success. I think there's going to be some evidence coming out that shows that those stats are not necessarily true. But to stay tuned on that. The unified decision, I believe, in what I read in the statement, and I encourage our listeners to go pull the statement that the board released once they came out of executive session. What to me is I've talked to certain people who are close to the situation is that she did not have the confidence of the board to lead the Atlanta public school system into the next phase. And I think that there was definitely some things that they articulated to her that maybe can't be made public. But I said this before on this podcast. If Maria Karstarfin only got 6 out of 9 people to extend her contract last time, so you had a third of your board who said we want another superintendent. So what you
and
saw
that was the last time.
So what I think the question was is that did she spend enough time cultivating those relationships with those board members that she needed to hold on to basically get her contract renewed? And I think what's evident is that that did not occur.
And we should point out here, WABE's broadcast license is held by the Atlanta Board of Education. Brian.
I think the behind-the-scenes maneuvering had more to do with personality conflicts than with the metrics of her performance.
And yeah, because they brought her in to put together a strategic plan and implement it, and they're still in the middle of that.
Right.
And then they're saying, wait a minute, we don't want you to do that anymore.
You know, 2 weeks ago, I said Superintendent Karstarfin is a change agent. And change agents break eggs to make omelets. And the eggs really get ticked off about it.
But if you remember the state of the district at the time they brought her in, that's exactly what they hired her to do.
I was in the governor's office at the time, and we had to get involved in that because of numerous problems with accreditation. But she is someone who is a very strong personality. A lot of the complaints of the board that you've seen here were the same complaints when she got pushed out of the Austin schools in Texas. You know, she gets out front on a lot of issues. She expresses her opinion on a lot of things that may not be the same opinion of the board members. So she faces the problems that a public personality faces. If you go out there and you take a stand on everything, you're going to step on a lot of toes. And she took a stand on a lot of things.
No one has said that Maria Karstarfin has not done some good things. It's three things that's missing. These things were done with the support of the board. And Brian knows this, right? If the governor goes out and does something, he always used to compliment the sponsor of the bills, or he would compliment the leadership. And he would even, you know, got criticized for it, but he would compliment Stacey Abrams sometime when they worked together on Hope Scholarship.
They worked on the Hope Scholarship.
This superintendent came out, not all the time, but sometimes it was I. So that was the first thing. The second thing is, it's the board's decision. So whenever a superintendent, he or she goes and applies for a job, whether you're a change agent or not, we know that if you look at the national statistics, the lifespan of a superintendent in the job of superintendent is only 2 to 3, maybe at most times 4 years. And so I think what the board was saying is that she's come in and done a good job for this particular phase and getting us on the right track. The third thing is this, and Brian just pointed it out. This is not new for the superintendent. When they hired her, there's articles out there that people can go and search themselves that said that this same exact behavior was one of the reasons why the board decided to not renew her contracts I think it was one before that, too. So what the board has said, and again, they can speak for themselves, but I'm just what I've read, is that they want someone who can be a collaborator. They feel was not enough collaboration with the city of Atlanta. There was not enough collaboration with the state and others. So I think they want to move forward together and find a new superintendent.
But gentlemen, very quickly, what about the kids? Does the board have a plan for where it goes from here? They're in the middle of a strategic plan that they put together with Dr. Karstarfin. Are they going to scrap that and start over? What's the message to parents and the business community who are wanting the momentum for change to continue?
The superintendent's contract does not end until June 30th of 2020. So with the decision, I think that, you know, our listeners will hear here pretty soon is that the board is going to come out with board approval to make sure it's transparent about what are the next steps to make sure that the public's involved, that the teachers, the parents, and the kids are involved about how they transition to this new phase.
Brian, are there signs here, though, that the electorate, the parents, and the constituents, the stakeholders in the school district are kind of tired of this because we just had a runoff for one district seat on the school board, just over 1,100 votes total, and we're going to have a runoff in that one. So are people either not caring or just fed up?
It has nothing to do with it being a school board election. It's got to do with being a special election in an off year.
In an off year.
That's just what you get.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but that's how that goes. It's not unusual. I don't think it's a sign of a wider thing. But it's a good time to be coming in, actually, because the district's kind of on the upswing. And I think Karstarfin gets some credit for that. So they can come in, and then there's some good things happening, and they can continue to implement the plan that's already there and maybe add on to it or change in some ways and that are productive that maybe we haven't thought about. But this job pays what? They're over $500,000.
She's making, roughly about $400,000.
Okay, so that's a 1%er job, not bad, and I think there'll be a lot of folks who would be interested in getting that.
On another point, Attorney General Chris Carr announced the state will join those states that have already joined the settlement agreement with Purdue Pharma, which makes OxyContin, and the potential here is for a lot of money to be coming to the state, depending on how the bankruptcy goes with Purdue Pharma. But, Brian, we have seen this movie before. There was the tobacco settlement. Huge amounts of money came into the state, supposedly to help with a major health problem, and it was diverted to other purposes. Legally, it could be. It went into the general fund, so it could have been spent on anything, and it was. Georgia was one of the states that spent the lowest percentages of the tobacco settlement money on tobacco prevention and tobacco prevention education. So what are the guarantees that we won't see this happen again with this?
You know, one of the arguments for putting the money in the general fund back then is the state's cost. The reason why they were getting this settlement is because they were spending so much money in Medicaid to treat smoking-related or smoking-caused disease. And the general fund pays for our Medicaid. And Medicaid is what drives the budget growth. Part of why we're having to cut in all these other agencies is because of enrollment growth and cost increase in the Medicaid program. It is a massive part of our budget.
So are you saying some of that money actually went to programs
for... You could argue that all of it did, because the money that goes into Medicaid grows so much every year, even when in the depths of the Great Recession, we kept spending more and more, which is why we had to cut everywhere else, even in greater amounts. So I think that was actually fair in the grand scheme of things. But if you want to, people want to earmark things because it makes them feel better. But look, what they did was practical and more efficient than earmarking. In this case, however, we are spending massive amounts, not only in Medicaid, but also in law enforcement, in incarceration, in the gang activity that a lot of this drives. So there are places where this money can go to directly address this problem, because it is a huge driver of cost for the state.
But the presumption is, Theron, that something new will be done, too, that there will be new outreaches, new efforts, new programs to address the rise in opioid addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, I mean, you got to commend the Attorney General here. And also, let's not leave out some of the local jurisdictions. There was a robust conversation about Fulton County and Atlanta and some of the metro counties, I think DeKalb and Gwinnett and Cobb. And so it's all about making sure that Republicans and Democrats and, you know, local leaders and state leaders and the federal government works together to figure out how to fund this.
You put all those pieces together, though, Brian. You have the income tax cut that some argued shouldn't have been passed at this point in the economic cycle. You have the cuts that the governor was talking about making and promising that he would make. Isn't it going to be tempting for state lawmakers to look at some of this opioid settlement money as a way to spend it on other things that they care about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And state lawmakers are already looking for new revenue sources. They are looking at sin taxes, for example. They're looking at gambling as a way to bring in new revenues to shore up hope. Others want to use the money to shore up rural health care access. There's definitely a look out there. But one thing we need to keep in mind as we discuss cuts of the state government, we're talking about a third of the state government. You know, two-thirds of it is sort of mandated spending. You've got to spend more on schools and Medicaid as those programs grow.
Some of the people I've talked to about these proposed cuts, we know that there is a huge problem in Georgia around elder abuse. And so if you look at some of these sort of cuts, are you cutting workers or resources for people who are trying to combat some of the elder abuse that's going on in our state? You know, Scott Holcomb got a lot of praise from his colleagues in the House, and I think Speaker Ralston and others, and I think even Governor Deal worked with him on rape kit. And so we know that that the GBI has come out and said they need to keep funding for a lot of these forensic scientists to make sure that these rapes are, try to prevent them from occurring. But even when they occur, you got to have the necessary resources and the manpower and the woman power to go out and investigate these things and to make sure they reduce the amount of rapes that happen in our state. And
so do Democrats go after the governor on those cuts? They also mentioned to an infant mortality program at Morehouse.
That's the Democrats' job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do they go after the governor on that, or do they, Theron, say, okay, here's some money that we can use, even though it was intended for opioids, and we can use it for these other programs that are also important?
Well, that's what Democrats should do. Democrats have got to get in the room and get in the conversation around those things that I laid out. And I think that, as Brian just pointed out, it's what the minority party does. If it was flip-flop, if Stacey Abrams was the governor of Georgia right now, you would have Republicans coming out saying a lot of these things that I just said. And so I think that the governor's office is aware that if these proposed cuts are going to deal with some of those departments and some of those things that I just pointed out. But I do think that with the opioid crisis that's going on in our state, with the funding, I do think Democrats will have an opening there to get in the conversation.
One final thought as we leave. We should take a moment to think of the contributions of Cokie Roberts, one of the founding mothers of NPR and a brilliant historian and commentator on not only public media, but commercial broadcast media through ABC. She was one of the people who, just by the way she did things, was an inspiration to a generation of journalists, including myself, to not only get the story right, but to do it right. Her contributions for recognizing previously unrecognized roles of women in history, women in newsrooms, amazing.
Well, what I was very just amazed to read the statements about Cokie Roberts from former President George W. Bush, who I remember seeing some of those interviews where
she was really tough on him.
Pushed him, and then President Barack Obama came out and praised her. And then let's not forget, too, Dennis, that she had a battle with cancer.
A long one.
And so in the early 2000s, just for my research and just remembering her, she fought through it. And she would still report the news, and she still would come out, and she beat it. And I think a lot of journalists today owe her a great deal of gratitude for really paving the way for them to have the opportunities that she had as a well-respected journalist.
I highly recommend the Nina Totenberg piece on the NPR website about Cokie. It's very personal and very moving, and really enjoyed reading that. And I grew up watching her because I was a news junkie even from childhood. And her voice just rolls over you like honey. It is, despite the fact that she grew up basically as a creature of Washington, the child of powerful politicians, and has made her adult life there, she still maintained a little bit of that Louisiana heritage and a little bit of that Southern lilt in how she talked. And I will miss hearing that beautiful voice over the airways on WABE.
And one other giant closer to home we should mention, Theron, the passing of Juanita Abernathy, who was a whole lot more than the wife of Ralph David Abernathy Jr., of course, former head of the SCLC. Juanita Abernathy, if you ever got to see her around Atlanta, was someone who just moved things in ways that you may not have seen, but you felt.
Oh, my God. I mean, I definitely want to pay tribute to her life that is so well respected by everyone. I mean, I have yet to meet a person that had a bad encounter, as you just pointed out, a good conversation with her about just what she could do to help you. And one of the things that I think that is not told about Mrs. Abernathy's role in the civil rights movement is that, you know, the late Ralph David Abernathy was a lieutenant to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
But succeeded him at SCLC.
Exactly. And so it was really Mrs. Abernathy's relationship with Mrs. Coretta Scott King that really helped fuel these two men in this movement. And then I want to just talk about her work here in Atlanta. When, unfortunately, Mr. Abernathy passed away, I mean, she served her community every single day. She was an outstanding member of the MARTA board. She was always about equity.
Yep.
She was always about making sure we expand transit. She was fighting for social justice for young people. She had a lot of education initiatives that she was a part of. And the last conversation I had with her, Dennis, was when she had heard some of my comments on television. And in a nice Juanita Abernathy type way, she said, "Come over here, baby. Let me talk to you a little about what you said on that show." And I walked away feeling like no matter what she said to me, she had so much grace, so much respect for you as a person, that even when she corrected me and what I didn't say enough of, I just love that about her. So she's going to be missed, and I just wanted to pay tribute to her on this podcast.
Two women with what you might think are not so much in common, but they both made everyone around them better.
Absolutely.
And that is it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Thanks so much again, guys.
Thank you, Dennis.
Have a great weekend, and go Dogs.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Theron is at Theron Johnson. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale. And I'm at DENISOHAYER. And if you like this show, subscribe. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. It's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We will be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.